your destination. Though you may find from time to time complications. Oh, the great Curtis Mayfield. That was an anthem back for me in college days, Curtis Mayfield's Move On Up. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Wednesday, September the 19th, and it's back to the blackboards for public school teachers and students in the city of Chicago. The teachers voted yesterday to accept a contract that the union had hammered out with the city, and they brought an end to a contentious 8-day strike. Stacey Davis Gates, who is now a household name right here on this program, is a legislative and political director of the Chicago Teachers Union. She's been briefing us on the strike all along, and she joins us now. Stacey, I'm sure you're glad that things are over, but there's a lot of business still to do.
Oh, my goodness. The end of the strike just signals the beginning of the next fight. So
No, I'm saying we'll get to the terms of the battle ahead. I wanted to start with the terms of the contract. What exactly has been agreed to, the major points?
Well, sure. We've gotten music, physical education, and art teachers, 600 additional teachers. So that's one of the things that we were able to push through. We maintain limits on class size and increased funding for smaller class size. We made sure the textbooks were available on day one of school. We've added a parent voice on the class size committee. We've, increased funding for special education teachers, social workers, psychologists, and classroom assistants and counselors in schools with high class caseloads. So those are some of the, you know, bigger things that we've done. As well, we were able to beat back some of the draconian measures that they wanted to put on the evaluations with regard to the percentages that are focused in on the standardized tests, which is huge, because we could see that putting our teachers in one of two pots, either you're a good teacher or you're a bad teacher, there was basically no middle ground. So we've worked hard to establish some middle ground. We've worked hard to also put together an appeals process. Our biggest fear with this evaluation is that student test score, because we know that no matter what test it is, that is going to impact communities in the black and brown neighborhoods more. So if you're a teacher who chose to go to teach in North Lawndale or in Englewood, those test scores, just based on the demographics of those neighborhoods, are not going to be higher because of the construction of the test. And so those teachers would be taking a great risk by going there to teach based on the percentages that CPS started with and where we ended up in the contract, and where we ended up was with the state law, because Race to the Top legislation basically this competitive grant for schools nationally, the state had to pass some legislation, and one of the pieces of legislation they passed here in Illinois was to provide an evaluation process that is in part test-based. And so what we were able to do is keep it at the state minimum, and that's a win, because, you know, obviously you have to go with what the state is requiring you to go with, but CPS wanted to make that even higher. So we were able to defend well against merit pay. So that's another good thing. But, you know, those things are good, but that's not it. You know,
No, there's still work to be done. We'll get to that. I wanted to ask also about the contract itself, and with regard to pay, what were the final terms and as that the teachers voted on?
3% year one, 2% year two, and 2% year three.
Why does it seem that it's, I mean, the information is that it's a lot. You got a heck of a lot of money, and that this was a fight essentially about money. But 3, 2, and 2 doesn't sound like a lot. It doesn't sound like an outrageous demand.
Well, what the city has been pretty successful in terms of their messaging is that it's 17%, but we reject that. They're adding in the compensation that teachers get for steps and lanes. So with years of experience and with increased education, you get a bump in your pay. So the city wanted to eliminate that completely. They wanted to eliminate that completely and put in a merit pay scheme. So we were able to maintain our steps and lane. So they are adding those percentages into the 17%, which is a bit disingenuous, quite frankly, because the raise is what it is. I mean, every year you get a raise for, or every year you get a bump for being an experienced teacher. So from year one to year two to year three. And then you also get a bump for the education that you obtain. And many of the teachers have said the Board of Education doesn't pay for us to go back to school. There are a lot of private companies that pay for their employees to go back to school and to, you know, increase their learning, but CPS doesn't do that. So in effect, the money that you do get for increased education basically helps to subsidize the money that you spent to obtain that education. So, you know, like I said, it's a bit disingenuous.
Well, now we can deal with some of the battles immediately ahead. What are those?
Well, immediately ahead is we know that up to 200 schools could be closed here in Chicago. And these schools will undoubtedly be on the south or west side of Chicago. We know that communities of color, impoverished communities, have bore the brunt of these school closings. And because of that, we are very nervous. And, you know, our membership, our teachers, they're just thinking, what's next and how much worse can it get? So that's the immediate issue. And we still have 160 schools that do not have libraries. Yet this morning I'm watching the news as I'm getting ready for work, and the mayor has a commercial that basically is going bullet point by bullet point what he won in the contract. And I'm thinking that if this commercial is running on all the local television stations, that you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on this, and we still have 160 schools without libraries. We still have hundreds of schools without play lots. We still have 17,000 of our students who are classified as homeless students, and those are the families who've chosen to document it, and I'm sure that there are many more that have yet to document this. We have profound structural, procedural policy issues within Chicago public schools, and, you know, we've chosen to take the high route and focus on the work that is yet to be done. And this commercial, you know, it's just like this is just another offensive move by City Hall and a very unnecessary one.
Well, this morning there in various media outlets, there were major pictures, big pictures of the mayor personally welcoming students back to school, which I thought was interesting. But let's talk about these schools that are in the bullseye now for closing. The union didn't just – this 8-day strike, I just wanted people to know, is really the culmination of more than 9 months of attempting to broker some kind of a sane contract with the city. The vast majority of the items on the table were not money or wage items, but actually working conditions and support services and educational services and the quality of those services to the city's 400,000 students, the vast majority of whom are African American and Latino. I wanted to know, I mean, this is a protracted fight that just culminated yesterday, but Is the Union battle-weary at this point, or is it yet about to mount another offensive in the style of unions, the aggressive style of unions around this school closing issue? Is it about to be the next leg of the race?
Well, it is. I think what we've been trying to convey to our membership and to the world, basically, is that this contract was going to be settled, period. We understood that kids were going to go back to school. But that did not mean that this larger issue of educational justice was one that we were going to allow to fall by the wayside. Educational justice is the grand scheme of this. The contract was a part of it, but not all of it. So certainly we are resolute in that. What happened with the 75% strike authorization that we had to get in order to even go on strike was that you were able to capture all 30,000 of your members and discuss with them very intimately the issues that plague their schools and how they fit into advocating for a better day, better resources, better funding, right? And so now you have created a union of activists. So, no, these people didn't even want to go home yesterday. I mean, certainly they wanted to go and prepare for their classrooms, but these people are fully captivated. I cannot tell you the hundreds and hundreds of emails that I have yet to answer because they keep coming. As soon as you get 10 done, there are 30 more that hits your box because they want to work.
So I want to draw on your expertise as a legislative person with the union. This struggle, of course, occurs within the context of a political environment, a political arena, and not just localized, but literally national and global. People have been watching this strike because it is so significant on so many levels. The union did manage to deal a number of pretty lethal body blows to Rahm Emanuel. In some cases, people are saying that, well, of course, he had other political ambitions. Being mayor was perhaps the start of it, but of course, he had aspirations for higher office. And this series of body blows that he suffered, including the court just throwing out his petition for back-to-work order, he's likely not to think fondly of this union as he goes ahead. What is the dynamic that the union is expecting with the strike settled, not officially yet because the voting process has to go through to ratify the contract, but with this climate now in Chicago, this climate of tensions between City Hall and the union, what do you expect could come of the initiatives still unresolved? Do you expect that you would have greater battles, or do you expect that?
Oh my goodness! Yeah,
you know, he's a more chastened mayor.
I don't expect chastened. I expect battle. We certainly do. I mean, we would hope that there would be some sort of meeting of the minds, a bridge built, and more collaboration. But if past practice is any indication of what you'll get in the future, we certainly expect more aggressive behavior, more aggressive action. Just today, one of the dailies, one of our daily newspapers printed an editorial which basically outlined what they would like to see done in our state capitol in terms of school policy to raise the cap on charter schools, to take away our right to strike, and to close more schools here in Chicago. So we understand that when you see something on the editorial page of this particular newspaper, that this is typically what you'll see done in Springfield or in Chicago, because they're just publicizing it slightly before it happens. So we expect aggressive. We certainly expect some aggressive behavior. We fully expect to have to defend against our right to a strike, which is, you know, a fundamental right that we have as a union. I think that they already signaled that they would be willing to do that when they made a 75% strike authorization vote that no one in this country has to obtain except for us. So, but we're ready. Our members are resolute. Like I keep saying, they're strong, they're unified. We have a sound leader in Karen Lewis, and we hope to continue spreading the message of educational justice and actually winning some of these battles and making sure that these our students in Chicago receive a world-class education. It shouldn't have to be like this. It's actually pretty demoralizing that the leadership of this city cannot find partners in the very people who provide the education in this city, because we need each other. You know, at the end of the day, we need each other. And this is a problem. This is certainly a problem. So hopefully, you know, after, you know, people sleep on it, they'll see, okay, I can see where there's some collaboration. But if not, you know, we'll continue to fight for the type of education we think they deserve. I mean, just last night, one of the billionaire advisors to the mayor was at a George Bush fundraiser, or Judge George Bush honor, I don't know, some sort of Republican event here in the city, where he said that he's seeking to make sure that teachers are separated from the teachers union. Now, this is the second time we've heard this. The first time we heard it, the mayor himself said it. So, yeah, I think that there are very clear signals that we are not a friend.
And he doesn't how see do that you, way. I mean, extending this argument, how do you read the state of affairs with the Democratic Party in the city of Chicago? The mayor is, of course, the most visible ambassador of the party, as you, if you will, and as such, has not really done much to, bring favor to the party on the by the citizens of Chicago, who are likely to be leaning toward the Democratic Party. Is there a sense that Rahm Emanuel is kind of a renegade Democrat, out of control Democrat? Is there no structure, no political party structure that was able or powerful or influential enough to bring him in line and say, listen, fella, you know, this is a presidential election year. Behave yourself. Tone down your rhetoric. Don't be so in your face and aggressive, and you're losing that battle, the public relations battle. You're not looking so good, and by extension, you're harming the party. Is there a sense that he's a kind of a Democratic renegade off, someplace in his own political sphere, and whatever the heck happens to the Democratic Party, it's all about him and what he gets with respect to his own political ambitions?
Well, I think there are a couple things that my mind went to as you were asking the question. The first one is that one of our labor leaders here in the city called him a Democrat nationally but a Republican locally. And I think that resonates clearly. And then the next thing I think about is the speech that Deval Patrick gave at the DNC, in which he admonished his own party for not having a backbone and standing up for the people who support them. So I think that this is clearly something, based on Deval Patrick's speech, that is a discussion within the party leadership, and that, you know, clearly we're disappointed that, you know, Romney and Paul Ryan and Rahm seem to have similar opposition is probably the better word for teachers. You know, they share similar opposition for teachers, and that's sad. That's it's troubling, actually. But, you know, hopefully Deval Patrick's speech, and where, you know, he admonished his party and said we need to grow a backbone, it's something that is being discussed and that, you know, hopefully they'll reconcile, because Labor and the Democratic Party have walked arm in arm. And it would be, you know, a shame that, you know, that relationship sours in some way. Because this is going to be a close election.
There's some unfinished business, too, Stacey, with regard to litigation. Just today, as a matter of fact, officially today was to be the day that the city was to have its back-to-work order reviewed by the judge that struck it down. Is the city abandoning that effort? What the city is trying to do is to get an official declaration that the strike was, in fact, illegal, perhaps for future litigation. Is the city abandoning that effort?
I think so. From what I understand is that effort has been abandoned. I think it was kind of like a Hail Mary to begin with. And, it was one of those things. Again, it was an aggressive move. It was one of many aggressive moves that we've experienced since before he became mayor.
And the union itself had filed an unfair labor practices charge against the city. Is it abandoning that?
Well, I haven't heard specific word on if we are abandoning that or not yet. So I'll know if we talk tomorrow. I'll have a specific answer for that one.
Okay. Well, how has this strike served as a template for other cities? And I know, this has been observed very carefully, and people are watching this struggle very, very carefully, because it is symptomatic of what has been going on in major urban centers across America. What do you think the lessons here have been?
Well, certainly democracy. I mean, I found it very disappointing that people didn't understand that our membership wanted to spend time with the contract and figure out if this was something that made sense to them. Again, we engaged 30,000 people on the issues contained in that contract, and we owed them a right to look through it and to come to some sort of determination. I also respect our leadership in, you know, a huge way for being courageous enough and trusting enough to be the leaders of a rank-and-file-led union. You know, that takes a tremendous amount of trust, that you listen to the people who elected you and you represent their wishes. And those people said, we want to read the contract. We want to have a clear understanding of what we are saying yes or no to before we make that determination. And that is a lesson for unions, internationally. I also think that this relationship that we've built and demonstrated how to build with our community and with the families that we serve, that this type of unionism is more grassroots and it's married to the very people that we serve. And that certainly is something that I think we need to look at internationally in terms of rebuilding unionism. You know, rank and file members are supposed to lead this. They're supposed to be empowered and as leaders of this union. You don't elect people to do your work for you. You elect them to represent the work you want done and that you yourself want to do. And I also think, too, is that we would not have been this successful. We would not have been this strong without our parents, without our community partners. And those things are critical in the 21st century in anything that you're doing, because people are so connected. One thing impacts the other thing. And so to not take those things into account and bring those people to the table and engage them is a mistake. And I think that that is one of the things that we did right.
Well, the other thing that you did right was actually, and you talked about it, it's coalition building internally. Could you tell us about the dynamics of the union itself? What are the demographics?
are within the internal dynamics of our union?
Yes.
Well, we have a president, Karen Lewis. We have a vice president, Jesse Sharkey.
I'm talking about the number of women, the racial makeup of the union, that kind of thing.
We're overwhelmingly female. I mean, we're heavy on the female side, so we're majority female. We used to be majority African American, but that number has evolved. A lot of our members here lately are younger than older. So it's actually changing significantly. And this, too, is based upon the composition of the schools and how they're changing. Because here in Chicago, we know that back in 2000, 40% of our teachers were African American, and they were women. We know 10 years later that only 19%, we know only 1.7% of our membership is African American male. So to say that the school actions, the school closings have had a disproportionate impact on African American students and families and African American teachers and school personnel is an understatement. And that's one of the things that we've been highlighting more and more, is to say that you have a system that's 90% black and brown, yet that's not represented in the people who stand before our children. And that opens up a whole other discussion in terms of cultural competency, in terms of making sure that our students have people standing before them that are role models, that I too can do this. So there are lots of things that we are still dealing with.
Well, Stacy Davis Gates, thank you so much for being with us again today. We've adopted you, as you no doubt have surmised, as our ongoing correspondent in this issue.
Well,
so
I appreciate
you have
that.
A double
thank
career.
You.
You're a news correspondent as well.
Well, thank you. Happy to do that. I've enjoyed this myself.
Thank you so much. When we come back, we'll talk about numbers, and we'll do that right after this. With 48 days to go till Election Day, it's a heated battle over the hearts and minds of voters to keep those already captured, to woo those still on the fence, and to even dismiss those deemed not worth romancing. It's a numbers game, and Lee Mieringoff, director of the Marist Institute for Public Opinion at Marist College in New York, has been tracking the numbers for many, many years. Lee, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. It's been too long since we talked.
Yes, been too long. Look, as it stands now, what do the numbers suggest about the election?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of polls, and if you put them all into a blender, I think you'd come out with the conclusion that you'd rather be in Barack Obama's shoes right now than Mitt Romney's. He's ahead in the key battleground states. He's ahead in pretty much all the national polls, or certainly most of them. But the lead is not very overwhelming. It's still a very close race. It's a competitive race. I think certainly the remaining several weeks will be determining, and perhaps the debate, which will be widely viewed, will be very critical. But right now, Obama has the edge, but as I say, it's not an insurmountable margin at this point.
Yeah, but still, with that very small edge, basically, it's safe to say that Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are ridiculously close in terms of numbers right now, but also significant is the number of undecided votes, even at this time, in those battleground states.
Well, what we're seeing is, and different polls are showing different things, and I think one of the things I've been struck by this campaign is that a lot of people have already picked sides. I mean, this is not a sit on the fence and wait to, you know, pass judgment kind of electorate. These voters have pretty much picked sides. The undecided has been quite low in most of the polls, and those who are committed to one of the candidates are pretty firm in their support. So the question of People are asked, you know, are you firmly committed or might you vote differently? Well, most people don't tell us they're going to vote differently. So what you're left with is sort of like a enough to make the difference, but certainly a not the kind of huge numbers of undecided folks, which is why we haven't seen major swings in these polls. In other words, it's for the longest time it's been 40-something to 40-something. President Obama now has gotten close to 50 in some of the states that we've also polled. But again, the undecided is in single digits, which is unusual. Usually people pick and choose to the end more. And right now it almost looks like the election's tomorrow as opposed to still, as you say, 48 days away.
Speaking of the word unusual, I want to just jump on that a bit. You've been doing these polls since chickens had teeth. I mean, you've been doing this for a long, long time.
Since 1978. I don't know what the status of the chickens were at that point, but
they were evolving teeth buds at
that
time.
Right, that's right.
But, you know, after a while, I guess in your business, there are certain things that, you know, you take for granted, and they are typical of the polls and the components of polls that you do. This, in your view, as a person with all this, these many years of experience in doing polls, considering the historic moment or the historical moment that this is taking place in, is there anything veering off the charts here to indicate that procedural way, there's something aberrant about this year's election, the character of this election in terms of voter attitudes, voting patterns, as opposed to the many, many years that you've been doing this?
Well, I think we just alluded to it a little bit, was that you have a group who's very firmly committed to President Obama's reelection. You have a group who's very firmly committed to Mitt Romney, and the middle has gotten squeezed. And usually that's where the determining voters are found. But if you look at both political conventions, I mean, both campaigns know this. They were pitching it to their base. It's all about mobilization right now, getting your people out, and very little about persuasion, trying to convince people who are going for the other guy to, you know, jump ship and come your way. And I think that's unusual. I think the other thing I would point to, which is, a little bit in a different direction, is that the polling community itself has increasingly become a target of politicization, where every time you put out a poll, you're ripe for the world of the Twitters, and you become sort of part of this back and forth, which has very little to do with what pollsters are actually doing, but nonetheless has gotten to the point where people's motives and ethics are challenged, and, you know, it's this kind of kill the messenger mentality, and I think that's really regrettable. So, I mean, I think that's part of it. And I think also, there used to be a time in our politics way back when you might disagree with people if they were going to be voting for the other guy, but just sort of respected their differing views. Now, if you're an Obama guy and you come across someone who's voting for Mitt Romney, or vice versa, you're for Romney and you stumble upon someone who's voting for President Obama, it just doesn't make any sense to you. In other words, you think they're sort of like a little nutty, because they just can't possibly be seeing the world, living in the same world that you live in. So I think we've lost a certain connection, a certain fiber. So I guess that's a long answer to how this campaign might be unique, but certainly it's certainly things that are occurring, and from where I sit, clearly the part on the polling and how we ourselves have been the object of some of these political harangues, it's kind of like unfortunate, because it's so not what we're about.
Right. What issues would you say, Lee, that have played a major role in influencing voter choices this year?
Well, I think it's no shock that the economy is so important, and I think that in a sense, the way it's being defined, on the one hand by Mitt Romney, with the kind of question, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, to point out to the failed hope and leadership, perhaps, of President Obama, and President Obama's retort, which is, let's not go back to the folks who got us into all this trouble in the beginning, to begin with, and that, the question may not be, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? The question may be more apt, is the country better off than it was 4 years ago? And then follow up by talking about how we were such on the brink of an economic collapse, and then that somewhat, campaigny line they use that Osama bin Laden is dead, but GM's alive. That kind of retort. So we have two very different arguments going on right here.
I wanted to know about the. This race is essentially a two-party race.
Yep.
What are you sensing, or what do the polls show about the appeal of third parties, and what impact are the third parties likely to have in this election?
Well, I think there is an appeal for an alternative, but when you come down to a close election like this, when emotions will only rise as Election Day approaches, there are some major third party or some significant third party folks who are running, one in Virginia, the former governor of New Mexico, Johnson, is running in a lot of states. The polling on them is not very precise, because sometimes people in a poll will pick a minor party candidate sort of as a none of the above, but when they get into voting booths, they don't go that way. So in a sense, I haven't seen a lot of polling on them, but the likelihood is that they will be overstated in the polls over what they get on Election Day, except from their home states. There's a guy, Good, who's running in Virginia. He was a congressman there. My guess is he might get some votes in his congressional district. That's not good news in this case for Mitt Romney. And as I say, Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, he probably could get some votes in New Mexico. I wouldn't be surprised by that. Beyond that, sure, in a close race, we could get into the situation where in 2000, some argued that Ralph Nader pulled votes from Al Gore in some of the determining states, and that can happen in a very close election, but I don't think these people are going to catch. There's nothing like a Ross Perot kind of, phenomena where they're going to, get into double digits. That's not the case.
Which constituencies, Lee, do you find a kind of obsession with in terms of how they are likely to behave, or how they have been behaving so far with respect to their political choices?
Run that by me again. I'm sorry.
Which constituencies are going to be emerging? Which political groups are going to be emerging as the key players in this election?
Well, as they say, if it's a close election, they all count.
Right.
But I think there are some groups that I think bear special watching, and in some particular states, for example, the Latino vote, which has grown in some places, clearly a group that is siding more with President Obama's reelection than Mitt Romney, but places like Virginia and North Carolina and Florida and Colorado and New Mexico and Nevada, very important states. This group is a more significant group in the electorate than it used to be, and it's a growing group, and it's a group that President Obama clearly needs very badly. The other group I'm watching closely is the young people. This is a group that obviously was the difference for President Obama as candidate Obama 4 years ago. If people under 30 didn't vote last time at all, he wouldn't have won. So his whole entire margin was in the 18 to 29 group. This year he still does very well with those voters, but they're not as interested. They're not as connected. I think you hear President Obama talking about college loans more. I think he's talking more to try to implore people to participate. If you listen to the Democratic convention, Bill Clinton, Michelle Obama, Barack Obama, they're all almost at the point of just not begging, but close to getting people to get back into this and close the so-called enthusiasm gap. So that's a critical group. And then I think on the other side of the equation, when you look at Mitt Romney, clearly there are conservative voters who he was everyone's second choice during the primary. So a lot of people liked Herman Cain, or they liked Rick Santorum, or they liked Newt Gingrich, or Rick Perry, and everybody was sort of shopping around and then sort of settled on Mitt Romney. Well, he's made great efforts and gone to great pains to energize the Republican base. The selection of Paul Ryan, for example, as vice presidential candidate was clearly in that direction. So the question becomes, will that group be there for Mitt Romney? Not that they're going to go for Barack Obama, or will some of them stay home?
Whether Republican or Democrat, Lee, is it your sense from polling that voters just across the board sense a change, a definitive change in their respective parties?
That's an interesting question. Clearly the two conventions speak to the base of the parties. My guess is that there's some more voters out there who are softer partisans. They're not as strongly connected to their political parties as maybe some of the folks at the conventions were. But in a sense, if you're a soft Democrat or a soft Republican, you don't have really any place to go but to the candidate of your party, because the candidates themselves have been really working to mobilize their base support at the ends, not in the middle. So in a sense, I guess to some degree, there's a lot of folks sitting home and wondering, what's happened to their political party. But right now, they will be there for them, because the alternative, for a lot of those voters, we return to the old lesser of two evils, and that may ultimately be part of what this election's all about in the end.
Well, some people say it's the lesser of two evils, and some people say it's the evil of two lessers. It depends on your point of view. But there's a general sense that it's an increasing thing. I'm talking strictly from my observation.
Sure.
in my circle of friends.
Sure.
That the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in this historical moment have become two wings of the same bird, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they're hardly distinguishable, except for an issue here and an issue there. Mm-hmm. But it is hard to discern a marked line of demarcation between the two. I mean, in terms of the practical experience that people have with both parties.
Well, I think the policies that the two candidates are espousing, to the degree that they are espousing policies, I mean, we're getting sort of bumper sticker slogans and in this campaign. I mean, I think if there's anything, also, you asked me earlier about how this campaign may be different. I think we're really bereft of really policy discussions of any sort. I mean, I know campaigns may not be the place for working out legislative agreements, but this is really a case where it's really been absent in terms of any kind of direction. So I think what you're picking up on also is that the candidates are not pitching much. These somewhat vague and platitudinous slogans, which don't really get to some fundamental issues that people are struggling with in their own daily lives. And, there's a lot of people having difficulty making ends meet. And, this last week we had no better example than on the one hand, Mitt Romney's, tape is discovered and played, and obviously, somewhat embarrassing to the Romney campaign that he was out there talking about this 47% of the country. The answer from the Romney campaign is to release a tape on Barack Obama from a decade ago when he talked about the redistribution of income in this country. So it's sort of my tape versus your tape. And, it kind of, I'm not so sure that the voters on the sidelines are connected with that as much as they want to get a sense of who these people are and what they're really going to do in a more concrete sense, or even in terms of policy directions. I mean, I think, you know, both sides in that degree have been guilty as charged. We're not getting much in the way of dialogue on the things that really matter to people. And, you know, we've got wars, we've got healthcare, we've got jobs, we've got environmental issues. I mean, there's a whole lot of things, and it doesn't necessarily work well in a campaign because we have all these TV ads just swamping. We don't get this much of those in New York and other states, but, you know, the places like Virginia and Florida and Ohio, where more than half of the ads of the entire country have already run just in those three states, the folks there are just getting bombarded by this avalanche of ads, a lot of which are negative.
Well, Lee, I know you're rushed for time, but I'm so delighted to have this reunion with you after all this time today.
Me too.
So thanks. It's a great start, and we'll be talking again.
Please call, and you know, it was a lot of fun to reconnect. I appreciate it a lot.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Well, we had an appreciation there, and one of the issues really that comes out is when it comes to party philosophy as such, you know, this is why I very seldom pay attention when people describe themselves ideologically, because nobody knows what it is anymore. If you were to ask the average Democrat, what does the party stand for? We're not voting for parties. We're not voting for party philosophy here. It's a celebrity match-off. You know, do you like this guy, even if you don't know him? Or do you like that guy, even if you don't know him? And it's about pitching individuals, personalities, the knowledge of the party, even by the party itself. The party doesn't know what it stands for. It has to remind itself with these ridiculous Hollywood productions that they call conventions. And they come up with things conveniently every 4 years to say, okay, yeah, we ought to stand for that, and therefore that makes us a party. There's no ongoing sense of identity as to what a party stands for, and therefore what voters are voting for. So it's a numbers game. It's all a numbers game. I want to thank you, and Gary was very, very warm again. For the reception here at PRN.FM has been fantastic. I want to thank you for that and for your letters and notes at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, Stories, leadstories@gmail.com. Thank you so much for that as well. And, you know, all these programs are designed for one purpose, which is, I think, the whole point of PRN, which is to get conversations going, get thoughts going. And I want to do that full steam ahead tomorrow. We've been doing a lot of listening. Let's do a lot of talking tomorrow. And tomorrow's program, I'm expecting serious debate. And no, you know, pontificating and just debate and bring your best game, because that's what's on tomorrow. We start these conversations. You've been privy to ideas, considered opinions, and expertise and knowledge offered here by various people on various subjects. And, of course, you add your own voice to that. And that's the forum tomorrow. I want you to be ready for that, because I'm going to be a hard taskmaster. You're going to have to stay on point, but get your points across and put your ideas out there for consideration, because it builds this reservoir of information that we can readily draw from in our day-to-day lives. That's what I think radio should do. That's what I think communications is all about, to get you ready to make sound decisions, because you're armed with sound information. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Again, the number, the address to reach me with your comments and ideas is Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, Stories, @gmail.com. I want you to know that you should stay tuned. Jack Rasmus with Alternate Visions comes up next, and we will join each other tomorrow right here. Tell your friends, though. Tell them this is an appointed time for them to tune in, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you so much.